It's very, very difficult to have a transparent debate about secret programs approved by a secret court issuing secret court orders based on secret interpretations of the law.
As details emerge about government surveillance, we still know precious little about how much of our online data is collected. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. A former Fox News producer turned Fox News mole tells us why he was so eager to bite the hand that fed him.
I saw myself looking down the barrel of facing another election year inside the walls at Fox, and I was like, I can't do this. I'm going to jump out the window and splatter myself on 6th Avenue.
And the surprising connection between iconic crooner Bing Crosby, Nazi Germany, and your laptop.
There's a direct link between all of the hard drives in the computers today, back to those original tapes that came over from Germany.
All that and more coming up.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Many developments on the recent leaks about U.S. government surveillance programs this week, and many, let's be blunt, reductive observations about the leaker.
Edward Snowden, an American hero or government nuisance for leaking those classified NSA documents. Let's put him through the spin cycle.
The spin cycle rotates irrespective of the value of Snowden's information. I mean, we don't know, despite the claims of intelligence officials, whether he endangered our national security. We may never know. We still don't know the impact of Army Private Bradley Manning's WikiLeaks leaks 3 years ago, a huge document dump that revealed much about the inner workings of the State Department. Manning's trial just began this week, but we passed judgment long ago on his character, his vulnerabilities, his angst. Now Snowden's inner life is, as Manning's was, endlessly evaluated. And whatever your opinion of Snowden, assume it's determined in large part by your view of what he did and where you stand on far bigger issues than his personality quirks. For example, the terrorist threat, the right to privacy, the nature of American democracy. For Congressman Ron Paul,
to tell the American people the truth is a heroic effort.
And the Government Accountability Project's Kathleen McClellan,
it's very courageous in this climate for anybody to consider making a whistleblowing disclosure.
As for Fox News contributor Andrew Napolitano,
I would describe this man as an American hero.
But House Majority Leader John Boehner says,
he's a traitor, and it's a giant violation of the law.
That's seconded by CNN's Jeffrey Toobin.
Every 29-year-old who doesn't agree with what the government is doing doesn't get permission to break the law, damage national security, and then run off to China.
And squared by retired Colonel Ralph Peters.
And oh, by the way, for treason, as in the case of Bradley Manning or Edward Snowden, you bring back the death penalty.
The corollary to the hero-traitor narrative is that of the weirdo misfit. You can catch a whiff of that in this remark by Maryland Senator Barbara Mikulski.
Why does a kid who couldn't make it through a community college can make $200,000 a year and be exposed to some of our most significant secrets?
Snowden said it was $200,000. It's really about $120,000. You can decide the significance of that. But he didn't finish college. David Brooks wrote in the New York Times that Snowden is one of the, quote, growing share of young men in their 20s who are living technological existences in the fuzzy land between their childhood institutions and adult family commitments. Richard Cohen wrote in the Washington Post that, quote, everything about Edward Snowden is ridiculously cinematic. He is not paranoid. He is merely narcissistic. Of course, neither man has ever met him.
I'm no different from anybody else. I don't have special skills.
Edward Snowden. If his impact on national security is unknown, so too is his impact on how we define ourselves as Americans. but it's worth asking.
I'm just another guy who sits there day to day in the office, watches what's happening, and goes, this is something that's not our place to decide. The public needs to decide whether these programs and policies are right or wrong.
I am neither traitor nor hero. I'm an American, said Snowden, as he was reportedly showing the South China Morning Post documents that revealed widespread NSA hacking in Hong Kong and mainland China. He said, the reality is that I have acted at great personal risk to help the public of the world, regardless of whether that public is American, European, or Asian. A big talking point in the last presidential election was American exceptionalism, the explicit idea, steeped in the implicit assumption of moral superiority, that America is special, that it has a special mission in the world. Newt Gingrich explains.
The fact is, what makes American exceptionalism different is that we are the only people I know of in history to say power comes directly from God to each one of you. You are personally sovereign. So you're always a citizen. You are never a subject.
Perhaps Snowden is an American exceptionalist. He says he's just a regular guy, but salt-of-the-earth humility is part of the exceptionalist proposition. A Pew poll released Monday found that 56% saw tracking of millions of Americans as an acceptable tool against terrorism. But a CBS poll released Tuesday found that only 38% approved of collecting the data of, quote, ordinary Americans. The word ordinary seems to have made an 18% difference. Millions could be anyone, but ordinary is definitely us.
He really looked like an everyman.
That's Joe Mullen, an editor at the technology news site Ars Technica.
For an IT guy who is dealing with the tech underbelly of the government, you know, in our community, he seems like the everyman in a certain context.
On Wednesday, journalists discovered that Snowden was an avid poster on Ars Technica's user forums. For more than 10 years, he corresponded under the name The True Hoo-Ha, a handle he'd used elsewhere online as well. Mullen has been reading Snowden's posts, which, taken as a whole, trace the thinking of a precocious teenager into a tech-savvy geek into an opinionated adult, seeking and offering help along the way. From the beginning, Mullen says, Snowden seemed at home in the Ars tribe. It's a place where nerd isn't exactly an epithet.
He definitely self-identified as a nerd. He was proud of it. He talked about how he wanted to make a gamer name for himself and that that gamer name would be Wolfking Awesome Fox. And he wanted other gamers to do it too. He wanted to learn how to surf the internet anonymously. He wanted to learn how to build a web server.
And he posted on things that really had nothing to do with technology. Can you give me a small sampling of what you ran across as you went back to the writings of The True Hoo-Ha?
Sure. He joined our forums in 2001 when he could have been about 17, according to the timeline we have. As early as 2003, he was talking with one of our writers and our editor-in-chief, Ken Fisher, and he was talking about his own agnosticism and sort of the nature of freedom, waxing philosophical.
But he also gave some clues as to his view of the emerging security state. Can you give me some examples?
As early as 2006, he would make jokes. There was a user in a forum who was asking about a strange noise that his Xbox 360 gaming console was making. And Snowden, as Hoo-Ha, said, oh, that's the NSA's new surveillance program. And of course, now we know he was probably working in the government in some capacity at that time. So he was sort of making jokes with our users about the government watching you while he was working for the government. In 2010, Snowden sort of responded to another Ars user's question about a piece of equipment built by Cisco. There was a discussion about a security flaw in a piece of Cisco equipment. The flaw was related to backdoors that had been built so that the government could use this equipment for wiretapping in some sense. Mm-hmm. He wrote, it really concerns me how little this sort of corporate behavior bothers those outside of technology circles. Society seems to have developed an unquestioning obedience towards spooky types.
It pains me and almost shames me to ask you this question, but having read all this stuff, have you seen anything that would answer for anybody who's asked till now, Ed Snowden, hero or villain? And by the way, does it matter?
I think people who look at his history on ours and the many statements he left on our site are going to see someone who comes off as a pretty regular guy. He was a young guy who sometimes said stuff that was off the cuff about girls and about what he was into. But I think for the half of the country that sees him as a hero, it is going to humanize him and it doesn't make him look like a bad guy. And for the half of the country that sees him as a villain, I don't know that it'll necessarily change their minds either.
There is one thing I do have to ask you about this. Edward Snowden wasn't writing under the name Edward Snowden. He was using this handle, The True Hoo-Ha, and he's been kind of outed. There's, I guess, some irony in the fact that he wished to remain anonymous and through forces beyond his control, no longer is. It's almost too pat. Have you given that any thought?
We certainly have. You know, Snowden was a person who knew what he was doing and was prepared for a blizzard of publicity about him once he leaked. You know, while he was anonymous, I think the Edward Snowden today absolutely knows that he has an online life. He had a life for over a decade, and that people are going to notice it, and that the media is going to see it, and that the government will also see it. You know, he wasn't that anonymous when you look at what he posted on ours. He gave so much detail about his life, his age, his employer, where he was living at different times, different jobs he's had. And then he also posted photos of himself. So we have ours members that keep a very low profile, and he really wasn't one of them.
Joe, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Joe Mullen is tech policy editor at Ars Technica.
Coming up, even after a deluge of stories on government surveillance, we're still like that blind man confronted with an elephant.
I think that national security reporting is really hard to do. You're often getting a piece here from one person and another piece here from another. It's very hard to pull the various pieces together on a national security program.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, and GatesFoundation.org, the Pew Charitable Trusts, working to help states provide voters with timely, accurate election information at PewTrust.org, and the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at Hewlett.org.
On the Media is supported by Air France, the official carrier for Marseille-Provence 2013, European capital of culture. A major attraction of the Provence region are the beaches of Nice and Cannes, which are known for sunbathing, discos, high-end shopping, and restaurants, whereas Antibes and the Cap d'Antibes, about halfway between Nice and Cannes, offer a quieter beach vacation. Tickets and information on daily flights to Nice and Marseille are available at airfrance.us.
On the Media is supported by Squarespace, dedicated to providing a simple way to create websites for those who are growing a business, starting a blog, or opening an online store. Squarespace provides templates and tools to create professional websites. Users create sites that are mobile-ready, which include 24/7 support, a domain name, and e-commerce, all on the same platform. For a free trial, visit squarespace.com/media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. And here's Senator Tom Udall.
It's very, very difficult to have a transparent debate about secret programs approved by a secret court issuing secret court orders based on secret interpretations of the law.
Udall was talking to General Keith Alexander, head of the National Security Agency, who was on Capitol Hill Wednesday defending the government's wide-ranging surveillance programs. What Udall didn't say was that the mendacity of the nation's intelligence chiefs made a difficult situation worse. For instance, back in 2005, General Alexander's congressional testimony on warrantless wiretapping was singularly unenlightening. When the New York Times exposed the program, Representative Rush Holt fired off a note slamming General Alexander for making, quote, a mockery of congressional oversight. And here's Senator Ron Wyden in a hearing last March asking Director of National Intelligence James Clapper a simple question.
Does the NSA collect any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans?
No, sir. Not wittingly.
Another flat-out lie.
Now, to briefly summarize the two big leaks that ignited the current blaze of controversy, the first was the revelation in Britain's Guardian newspaper that the U.S. government routinely requests millions of Americans' phone records. The second revelation was about a program called PRISM, depicted by the Washington Post's Barton Gellman as an intrusive enormity. PRISM, he wrote, gave the government direct access to the servers of Google, Microsoft, Yahoo, Apple, Skype, and others, quote, enabling analysts to track a person's movements over time. But within hours, almost every company he cited denied giving the feds direct access. In later reports, Gellman walked back some of his claims, including the one about direct access, and went on to specify that PRISM is intended only for foreign targets. Intended, but how many Americans are swept up in the net?
We don't know that, or much of anything else about the program. Kim Zetter covers civil liberty, privacy, and security for Wired. So, Kim, how outraged should we be?
You know, we've sort of had a long-standing outrage over this program for about a decade. But what we know about the PRISM program doesn't seem as damaging on the face of it based on those initial allegations. And those initial allegations were saying that the government had direct access to reach into the servers of 9 internet companies, and we're doing bulk collection. The internet companies have denied it. What Google is saying is that they use secure FTP to upload these documents, and then the government downloads them.
FTP servers, like any one of us can use to send a large document, only these were encrypted.
Right. This isn't secret technology that's coming out of some skunk work project of the NSA. This is something that everyone uses. Yes, you trade documents this way. In some cases, they said that they give them to the NSA in person. It's the sneaker net, essentially, hand-walking them over.
So will you explain to me why that makes it better?
First of all, it's not direct access to anything. The government isn't reaching into the server and grabbing whatever data it wants. Google is looking at the court order, deciding if it's legal, deciding if it's targeted enough or too broad.
But you make it sound like the court orders are like you'd have to go through for, say, a wiretap. You need to identify a suspect. You need to have probable cause. That's not the case in these orders, is it?
No, it's not. And that is a problem. We don't know what the FBI is saying when it goes to the court and makes a claim for records. All we have right now is Google saying that they will only respond to orders that are targeted, but no one has defined what targeted means.
Nobody is suggesting that those slides that appeared in the Washington Post and in the Guardian about the PRISM program were invented. It makes it appear a lot more expansive than Google and some of those other companies are saying it is.
This is the frustration of the companies, is that they've been caught in this because, you know, the blame goes to them. Why are you allowing the government to do this? And so they want to be more transparent and they want to explain. And the government is saying, we can't explain because it will give away our methods. I don't fully trust those slides. I don't know who made those slides. I don't know who the audience was. It's been suggested that it was a marketing tool. But when you've got something that's out of context, and I think that this is the problem with the Post stories and the Guardian stories, is that they were counting on Edward Snowden, the leaker, to interpret it, and he didn't have direct information about it either. So everyone is sort of interpreting these slides out of context.
One reason why we called you is because you have expertise and a cool head. But you wouldn't claim this is a non-story, would you?
It's simply not the story we thought it was in the beginning. I think the onus is on the government to tell us what the nature of these collections are, and also on the companies. They want to be able to publish at least a broad range of figures of the number of accounts that have been affected by FISA. So that would give us some idea. If we get a figure from Google that says the range is between 0 and 1 million, that's going to give us an idea that this is really broad. If Google comes back and says the number of accounts affected are between 0 and 100, then I think we can kind of rest easy.
Did you have a problem with the way this story was initially reported? And if you did, was that problem something you see a lot in national security reporting?
I think that national security reporting is really hard to do. It's very hard to get people to talk with you. It's very hard to pull the various pieces together on a national security program. You're often getting a piece here from one person and another piece here from another. In this particular case, I don't want to criticize the reports. I think that their intentions were good. I think they may have moved too quickly. I think that if they had slowed down, spoken more with technical people rather than officials, when it's a technical story, you really should get down into the weeds and talk with people who understand the technology. So I think that that was a problem here.
So is it fair to suggest that when reporters tried to report on PRISM, it was like the blind man feeling the elephant? They could only identify the tail or the trunk?
Yes, that's exactly what was happening here. And they don't have all the pieces. And so what they did was they reported when they had a few of the pieces of the puzzle together. Even the sources that they're speaking with about the documents that they received may not know the whole picture. A lawmaker said after getting a briefing from the intelligence agencies, what we know right now publicly is just the tip of the iceberg of what the intelligence agencies are doing. So even if the PRISM story didn't turn out to be what we wanted or hoped it would be, which was, you know, a real look at what the government was doing, what it did do is spark this conversation. More people know what FISA is now than ever before. More people know that there's such a thing as a FISA court, and we're having this dialogue, and this is extremely important.
Kim, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Kim Zetter is a senior writer for Wired.
At no point in history have civilians been more vulnerable to government surveillance or prying by private companies. And what a curious trio of factors that have brought us here. Fear of terrorism on the one hand, the profit motive on the other, and on both hands, the fun and convenience of life online. Whether for utility or security, loss of privacy is a trade-off and perhaps the defining bargain of our times. Earlier this year, OTM producer Sara Abdurrahman explained why most of us still cling to the notion that we, with a few simple precautions, can handle our own security when we venture online.
In response to the new Facebook guidelines, I hereby declare my copyright is attached to all of my personal details, illustrations, graphics, comics, paintings, photos, and videos. This will place them under the protection of copyright laws.
If you're on Facebook, chances are that you've recently seen that statement on the walls of your Facebook friends. You might have even copied and posted it yourself. It went viral. But as the Electronic Frontier Foundation's Ava Galperin observes, it was all a hoax.
The sort of wishful thinking that really powers this hoax is if you do this fairly simple thing, you will not have to do the hard work of protecting your privacy or protecting your data. Often it stems from a misunderstanding about how the internet works or how privacy works.
A lot of our behavior springs from that misunderstanding. We take some measures to protect our data, but they're often the wrong measures. It's like ordering a Big Mac, large fries, and a Diet Coke. The intentions might be good, but we won't get the results we're looking for. Same with that viral Facebook meme. Within hours, countless people wasted time posting it to their walls. But according to Sarah Feinberg, Director of Policy Communications at Facebook, when they actually offer their users a real chance to vote on how the site is governed,
very few users were engaged in the vote, far less than 1% of users. My sense is that many more people were focused on the copyright meme.
Our privacy attitudes and our behavior are much less rational and stable than what we may like to believe.
Alessandro Acquisti co-directs the Center for Behavioral Decision Research at Carnegie Mellon University. He says the more you believe yourself to be in control, the more likely you are to act. The people who posted that bogus copyright notice on their Facebook wall felt like they were in control.
On the other hand, at the Facebook election, I can express my preferences, but really I have no guarantee that these preferences will be satisfied.
Of course, it's not just Facebook. Anytime you use a service from what's known as a third-party provider, you are subject to its terms, and that usually means it owns your data.
So, if you're using Gmail, your mail essentially belongs to Google, and Google can decide what they want to do with it. Google has a privacy policy that says they will not give it up, but they're not required to do so.
Galperin says people don't really grasp the lowly legal status of their emails.
And they don't have the same Fourth Amendment protections that they would if the mail was sitting in their house. And governments and law enforcement agencies, even people involved in civil cases, could possibly come to the webmail provider and get that information with a warrant.
In fact, even without a warrant, if your email is older than 6 months, Ryan Single, former editor of Wired.com's Threat Level blog, says that's a byproduct of an outdated law.
When they originally set up electronic privacy law in the 1980s, everybody always downloaded their email. You didn't leave it on the server, so anything over 6 months was considered abandoned. Whereas these days, you leave stuff up on the internet forever in your accounts.
But what if you don't actually send your electronic correspondence? Remember that affair between General David Petraeus and Paula Broadwell? The couple reportedly used a tactic favored by terrorists and teenagers to keep their communication secret. They left their messages as drafts in a shared email account.
Well, the idea is that if you write a draft to someone and you leave it there, the email never gets sent to that person, right? So there's one less hop, which means like one less place for somebody to see something.
And if the director of the CIA can't cover his tracks online, what hope is there for the rest of us?
People often think if they throw something in the trash and delete it, that it's therefore off of their computer. That is not the case. People think that if they erase their browser history, that nobody's going to be able to figure out where they went online. It does make it a lot harder, but it's not impossible to get. Skype is one. People think things are encrypted. It is encrypted, but most of the time Skype saves chats on your computer. People make mistakes about using open Wi-Fi or neighbor's Wi-Fi to do things that aren't legal. The other one I love is that businesses put those little disclaimers down at the bottom of their emails that, you know, this email is only intended for the intended recipient and you can't forward it on. That has absolutely no meaning whatsoever.
So, why do people do it?
Because it might scare people, but every lawyer I talked to has said, no, that's not true. So if you get an email that's not intended for you and it's got some crazy secret, send it on to the New York Times. You're not going to get prosecuted. The internet is a giant copy machine. Anything you put on the internet can be copied and sent around. I just hope you have nice friends.
The reality is that once you release an email into the world, or post a Facebook status, or even send an off-the-record chat, you have no control over what happens to it on the other end. And even though many companies that you store private information with online promise not to disclose any of it,
those promises are no good when the rule of law comes into play.
Computer security researcher Jacob Applebaum says even the most well-intentioned company has to comply with the law.
That's happened to me with my Gmail account. The U.S. government took my Gmail with less probable cause than a search warrant would have required by far.
He says the only way to keep companies from divulging your personal information is to encrypt it, all of it, so they can't collect it in the first place.
The trick is to change it from a dynamic where you basically say, please promise not to take this data, but they do anyway, or they've been compromised, so they don't know they're doing it, and takes it to a place where they can log it all they want, but whatever they log is worthless because it's encrypted.
So now it's on you. What a pain. You might think, who cares if my information isn't private? I've got nothing to hide.
So does it matter if Google knows that you're gay? Well, I don't know. Do they have any homophobic engineers with access to that database? For example, in Uganda right now, they're trying to pass what people call the Kill the Gays bill. And that is a great example where today the information about you, which can be found by your social network, that's a life or death issue.
Your online life can be targeted for any number of unexpected reasons. Just ask Wired magazine writer Matt Honan, who recently had his whole digital life destroyed by hackers.
They had gone after me because they saw that I had a 3-character Twitter handle, which was sort of valuable real estate. So everything they did was all kind of collateral damage to get that Twitter account.
Collateral damage, including wiping away years of messages, documents, and every photo he'd ever taken of his 18-month-old daughter. Honan's sobering experience taught him that the one thing we all use every day to shield ourselves online, the thing that makes us feel protected and in control, the password, is actually a dangerous illusion.
A password is just a string of data, and there are all kinds of ways to either get around it or get it and copy it.
Honan says a password is especially vulnerable because it is a singular point of entry that can be attacked from multiple fronts, through malware on your devices, large password dumps online, phishing, brute force, or the strategy used to get into Honan stuff, password resets. And a person trying to break into your online accounts can often reset your password using information already available online.
If I call up tech support and I happen to know, say, your mother's maiden name, which I've gotten from Ancestry, or your high school mascot that I've gotten from classmates, or your date of birth that I've gotten from Facebook, I'm most of the way there to getting a password reset.
And you know that password trick we're always told to use, replacing letters with other symbols?
A 5 for an S, a dollar sign for an S, a 4 for an A. If you can think of it, there's a computer program that can do it.
And go ahead. Keep trying to make your passwords longer and more complicated.
It's an arms race between how many characters you're willing to enter in and how good our computers and the programs that we run on them are going to get.
And of course, we all know we're not supposed to reuse passwords in multiple places. But repeating password patterns is no good either.
Some people will do this thing where they'll have a password that could be, say, 123 Google. And they'll think, okay, well, that's my Google password and my Facebook password is 123 Facebook. And so it's totally different. But it's not. People reuse passwords because they don't know how else to remember a good password. This has been the long-time problem with security. People won't take steps to secure their information unless it's convenient.
It's precisely that trade-off of convenience over security that keeps people online.
We can walk down the street and ask Google, what's the best place for sushi within 3 blocks? Facebook has been really great at keeping people connected. If you want to have a party and you want to invite people or share photos with all of your friends, like, that's really pretty cool, actually. So it's hard when you kind of balance the things that you get with it with the things that you don't want. Like, you don't know if you put that picture up, who's going to see it? And, you know, how do you keep a stalker from coming after you? Or how do you keep an ex-boyfriend from keeping tabs on you on Twitter?
Anyone can copy this text and paste it on their Facebook wall. This will place them under the protection of copyright laws.
I, for one, did not post that Facebook disclaimer on my wall because I don't have a Facebook wall. Staying off the social networking site is my way of asserting control over my digital identity. But then again, I'm also guilty of using a Diet Coke to wash down my metaphorical Big Mac. I may be off Facebook, but I use Gmail, have a smartphone, communicate over Skype, pay bills online. It's all just too convenient. For On the Media, I'm Sara Abdurrahman.
Coming up, erstwhile Bill O'Reilly producer turned Gawker mole describes his very short-lived undercover mission.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. This is NPR.
On the Media is supported by Squarespace, dedicated to providing a simple way to create websites for those who are growing a business, starting a blog, or opening an online store. Squarespace provides templates and tools to create professional websites. Users create sites that are mobile-ready, which include 24/7 support, a domain name, and e-commerce, all on the same platform. For a free trial, visit squarespace.com/media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last year, an anonymous Fox News Channel employee started writing for the news and gossip website Gawker. The pen named Fox Mole was associate producer Joe Muto of The O'Reilly Factor. At least he was for the 36 hours before he got caught. Before that, Muto leaked photos of a bathroom stall draped in toilet paper and pre-interview video footage that made a couple of conservative pundits look ridiculous. The first was a so-called secret video of Newt Gingrich being groomed by his wife Callista and ribbed by Bill O'Reilly.
Tell Callista that you, a little more spray on the back.
Yeah. Don't encourage her, Bill.
Well, if you, Mr. Speaker, if she moves the front down a little bit, then you got the Justin Bieber thing going on.
Then came Mitt Romney chatting with Sean Hannity about show horse dressage.
I have a Missouri Foxtrotter. It moves very fast and doesn't tire, and it's easy to ride, meaning it's not boom, boom, boom. It's just a smooth.
A little smoother.
Very smooth.
What Muto didn't manage to post online from the inside, he's just published in his book, An Atheist in the Foxhole, A Liberal's 8-Year Odyssey Inside the Heart of the Right-Wing Media. Joe, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Okay, you were a mole for 36 hours, but you weren't a mole during the entirety of your 8 years there. You were there for reasons that had nothing to do with leaking anything.
You know, I was there as an employee for years and years and years, and this never entered my mind to even do this until very late in the game.
All right, what's the most appalling thing you saw in your tenure there?
That video of Newt Gingrich getting groomed by his wife. That was horrifying. Oh, man. It wasn't any one thing. I mean, the final straw for me, I guess, was not even on our air, was that it was an item on the Fox Nation website, sort of the Drudge Report-style offshoot of FoxNews.com. And it still boggles my mind how the network can operate a site like that. And there's a lot of what I would consider race baiting going on there. And the post that really did me in was this one that said, Obama's hip-hop barbecue didn't create any jobs. It's because Obama had Charles Barkley and Jay-Z to his birthday party. So obviously it's a hip-hop birthday party, and you know, he should never do anything at all except for, you know, sit in his office and think really hard about how to create jobs. He's not allowed to do anything else. That was in late 2011, and I saw myself looking down the barrel of facing another election year inside the walls at Fox, and I was like, I can't do this. I'm going to, you know, jump out the window and splatter myself on Sixth Avenue. It was a spur-of-the-moment thing. I reached out to Gawker and, you know, said, I work at Fox. I'm leaving here in a few weeks. I'd like to come maybe work for you after I leave. And
they said, how about we suggest a plan B?
Almost verbatim. That's what happened. And, of course, my dumb ego kicks in, and I go, great idea. Of course. Why wouldn't people want to hear my anonymous dispatches from inside Fox? And they'll never catch me. I'm a genius, you know? And, and of course, it blew up in my face.
You were sort of a spy in the midst of your employer's operation. You're a criminal.
I have pled guilty to 2 misdemeanor charges. That is correct. I have a record. Let's just say I want to tell your listeners that it was not a well-thought-out plan.
So one is obliged to ask, how do you get it in your head as a liberal to go work for Fox News Channel, an explicitly right-wing enterprise?
In 2004, I found myself about to graduate college, and I just found myself desperate to get to New York City. And so I started sending out a flurry of resumes. Fox was one of the ones that responded. I went for an interview. I thought I had blown it. And 2 weeks later, they called and offered me the job. There was some foreboding on my part. I was a little worried, you know, I'd have to, you know, goose step or something down the hallways once I got there. But I told myself I'd give it a shot. And if I didn't like it, I'd leave in 2 or 3 months and find something else. And I blinked my eyes, and it was 8 years later.
Along the way, you observed a number of things that, you know, sure seem comical in a kind of dark way about the quirks of this news organization, if it is, in fact, a news organization. Is Fox News Channel a news organization?
Well, let me put it this way. We all knew, from the liberals to the most conservative producer in the building, that Fair and Balanced was a sham. We were not there to report the news in a fair and balanced way. We were there to report the news and put our own spin on it and sort of gin up our viewers. We used to call it stirring up the crazies, because the angrier they were, the more they would watch. But not everyone there is fully committed to slanting the news. There's a lot of people there who are journalists.
You talk about Sarah Palin, and you seem impressed by how monumentally ill-prepared she was for every air appearance, practically playing a caricature of herself.
It was shocking to me that she could take this money from Fox and do even less than the absolute bare minimum. And they weren't asking a lot of her. They were asking her to come in, do 4 minutes of TV, and dash off a few good lines, and she couldn't even be bothered to learn the topic we were talking about. O'Reilly really wanted to help her. He always thought she got a raw deal from the liberal media. He's like, help me help you. And she just wouldn't. And she was being very difficult. And eventually he just washed his hands of her and said, I can't have this woman on the show anymore.
What you write about O'Reilly in the book, and you say you kind of like the guy, suggests he's very smart, really understands TV, and has a volcanic temper about not just important things, but about everything.
Yeah. As you can imagine, this will come as a surprise to no one who has ever seen his show.
You sucked it up for 8 years.
Bill is such a larger-than-life character that when you work for him, your every waking moment is devoted to pleasing him. My part, for example, was to just give Bill correct information. And I did that. I never gave him incorrect information. I never, you know, tried to sabotage the show from within, partially because he would have murdered me on the spot, but also because I took pride in my work. I wanted to do the best job I could, and I wanted to sort of keep him honest.
Yeah, how did that work out?
Well, it was hard to keep him honest because once he gets a fact or figure in his head, it doesn't matter if that fact or figure is wrong. The most recent example I can think of is that he reported that the IRS head met with Obama at the White House 157 times. Turns out I think it was something like 11 times. He hasn't corrected the record yet. You can't dissuade him. You can show him all the evidence in the world. He's stubborn like that. It hurts him. His staffers are afraid to correct him. But it's hard to 100% dislike the guy. He is charismatic in small bursts. And I think it's fair to say he's sort of a genius at his profession. I mean, he's been number one for 13 years now, I think it's been. This is so weird to say, and I'm going to sound like a crazy person, but I still have dreams about him, about working for him. I compare it to those old dreams where you're in math class and you've forgotten to study, except I'm in a pitch meeting with O'Reilly and I have no pitches to give him. And there's just this sense of, you know, low-level panic. He's such a pervasive, larger-than-life character that it does, I don't want to say it's haunting me, but that's kind of what's going on. It's kind of haunting me.
Joe, good luck with the book. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Joe Muto is author of An Atheist in the Foxhole, A Liberal's 8-Year Odyssey Inside the Heart of the Right-Wing Media. Full disclosure here, on a few occasions, Papa Bear has singled out our program to hate on. But once in 2011, he kind of liked us.
There's a guy named Bob Garfield, no relation to the cat.
Right.
Who does a co-host the On the Media NPR program. Here's what he said. Go.
You and I both know that if you were to somehow poll the political orientation of everybody in the NPR news organization and at all of the member stations, you would find an overwhelmingly progressive, liberal crowd. Not uniformly, but overwhelmingly.
Well, at least Garfield's honest.
In the early days of radio, the nation's biggest singing stars came from vaudeville, where volume was prized and emotion was delivered with a jackhammer.
I've been away from you a long time. I never thought I'd miss you so.
And then Rudy Vallee came along, the first crooner.
Way soon this morning, I come knocking at your door.
Managing to achieve something like intimacy, even when singing through his famous megaphone. He was, in fact, a megastar, but the nation's most enduring, its biggest and best crooner was definitely Bing. I don't even need to say his last name.
Every hug seems to act just like a drug. You're getting to be a habit with me.
Okay. Crosby. Paul Ford wrote on the New Yorker website that Bing Crosby helped change American popular singing, changed the way radio is produced, and is even responsible, in part, for the birth of Silicon Valley. And then there's that connection to the Nazis. It's not bad, don't worry. Paul, let's dive into this winding tale. The story starts with just a vaudeville stage. Actually, Bing did start out in vaudeville, right?
That's right. He comes out of, well, not exactly vaudeville, but on the stage. He comes out of Spokane, Washington, and he's singing with a megaphone and lands in Paul Whiteman's jazz orchestra, one of the places where jazz sort of starts to form in American culture.
Actually, we have a recording of him with Paul Whiteman's orchestra.
From Monday on, my cares are over. From Monday on, I'll be in clover.
Now, back in those days, even when making a recording, they didn't have mics?
Not always, no. They would actually sort of yell into a horn in the wall. It would write on the wax cylinder, and that's how you get that kind of crrrring and sort of scratchy sound. I don't think there was any electricity actually involved there.
So then the microphone seemed to change everything, especially for Bing.
Well, he had this sort of beautiful baritone voice, and it wouldn't hit the rafters in the same way as somebody like Jolson's voice might. But for Bing, he could get up close to that microphone, and it sounded like he was in your ears. It was very sensual, it was very intimate, and it just took off.
That sort of crooning created, you say, a moral panic.
That's right. People were very, very upset at this change in style, and they thought that the crooning represented pretty much the end of morals as we knew it.
You quoted Cardinal William Henry O'Connell saying, "Crooning is a degenerate form of singing. No true American would practice this base art."
That's right. And the New York Singing Teachers Association chimed in, and they say, "Crooning corrupts the minds and ideals of the younger generation."
Why?
You know, these youth show up, they're all sexual, and they're singing intimately into the ears of America's maidens, and all of a sudden, it's like Time Magazine writing about the millennials.
So you think it was just a function of the fact that these were young people, but there was something unique and something that couldn't have been done before the development of microphone technology on such a wide scale.
But it's always a combination. The thing that people talk about when they talk about the millennials is that they're all on their, you know, they're text messaging all the time, or they're all on Facebook. Mm-hmm. It's youth plus technology equals just tremendous disgruntlement.
Okay, so then Crosby becomes a huge star in the 30s and the 40s. And in the mid-40s, World War II ends, and America starts picking through the remains of Nazi technology. And they find magnetic tape, which the Nazis had been using to send out propaganda.
That's right. Now, to be clear, magnetic tape shows up in Germany in the late 20s. It's not purely a Nazi invention, mm-hmm. but it definitely was used by Hitler and the regime to broadcast all throughout the Reich.
The Allies didn't use it?
They didn't have it. It just wasn't a technology that had made its way to the United States. If you were recording a radio show, for instance, used a great big wax platter.
What was so good about magnetic tape?
You can cut it. You can paste it back together. You can splice it. You can record over it. You can do multi-tracks. It changed audio entirely. It used to be so linear. And now it's this medium that you can manipulate, and you can play around with time in ways that you never could before, which means that you can make mistakes and fix them.
Crosby immediately saw the value of it, right?
Somehow people knew to bring this technology to him. One of the deals he made when he set up his Philco Radio Hour was that he would be able to, at that point it was called transcription, transcribe it onto the disc, and then it would be played back. It also meant you didn't have to do multiple shows from multiple time zones. So he was primed. This was something that was totally on his radar. People knew that and said, "Hey, you might want to take a look at this tape recording." And he said, "This is great. What do you got for me?" And they said, "Well, we don't really have any machines." So he funded a small company called Ampex. I think it was about six people at the time. He gave them around $50,000. And he said, "Go, make me some tape recorders."
I worked with Ampex decks when I was, you know, editing in radio as recently as a dozen years ago.
Well, and that's the thing. Ampex was a real fundamental technology company in American history, and especially in Silicon Valley. The Ampex sign is sort of still up there. And tape recording, it not only was a way to record sound, it became one of the first ways to record data off of computers.
And it was his $50,000 investment that started that ball rolling?
That was the origin. I mean, it's definitely the origin of tape recording in America. That sort of came along. People saw that it worked for audio and realized it could work for data as well.
So how did Bing use it back when he was producing his radio hour?
His show was known for being paced a little bit differently because they had more control. Things are edited and manipulated, and that there's some play in how they're constructed. So it was tape recorded in the modern sense. His was the first show to do that.
And you say that he invented the laugh track.
It was either he or a producer. They wanted a stronger laugh. And they said, go back and get that old laugh. And that was that. That's how it started.
Now, in your piece, you talk about one of the guys who developed the first hard drive.
Right.
And he spoke about the Crosby connection in his book.
As IBM was funding the creation of the first hard drive, they're looking at all these different technologies. There was magnetic core memory. There, of course, were things like paper tape and punch cards. And there were the magnetic tapes, like the kinds made by Ampex. And the hard drive was a specific reaction to all of these technologies that came before. But itself, it's also another magnetic technology. And so the history of the magnetic tape, there's a direct link between all of the hard drives in the computers today, back to those original tapes that came over from Germany.
He also recognized another technology.
Fun fact, there is a patent with his name on it for a kind of window sash, but I think what you're talking about is that he was an early investor in flash freezing. And thus, he ended up with a very, very big role in the development of Minute Maid. He became known, really became associated with orange juice.
Bing Crosby loves Minute Maid.
Here's wonderful news for you and me, that Minute Maid gives more vitamin C.
There is a kind of funny connection between freezing, flash freezing, and capturing things on tape.
You're grabbing them for future use. In one case, you're going to cut and paste something into a more interesting radio show. In the other case, you're going to have a delicious glass of orange juice.
Manipulated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But even better.
Paul, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Paul Ford is a writer and computer programmer. His piece about Bing Crosby ran on the New Yorker's Elements blog last week.
Don't cry. Oh, honey, please don't be that way.
Here's my favorite Bing Crosby song. We used to have a gramophone when my kids were small, and I played this song over and over again.
And the rain will bring the violets of May. Tears are in vain. So, honey, please don't be that way.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary. We had more help from Olivia Wheats and Molly Buckley, and it was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news and our boss. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.